Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today as we talk about ways to lengthen your growing season. With us from Minnesota, Meg McAndrews-Cowden, author of the book Plant, Grow, Harvest, Repeat. It's a dandy book. I really like it, and I think you're going to love hearing about it. And of course, she'll talk about it and answer your questions as well as we move along here today. She is a self-taught gardener, organic gardener with an advanced degree in natural resource management. And you can follow her on Instagram at seed2fork. So as we talk with Meg, I hope you'll join in. What would you like to know about succession planting? What's going on in your garden right now that you have questions about? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Meg McAndrews-Cowden, welcome to the show. It's great to have you with us.
Hi, Larry. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here and chat gardening.
Well, I tell you what, I really like your book.
Oh, thanks. I put a lot of love into that thing and a lot of years of experience.
Yeah, it's the concept is succession gardening. And for those who aren't familiar with it, maybe just define what is succession gardening.
Sure. The shortest possible way I would say succession gardening is really making sure that your garden is as productive for as long as possible. And we do that by lots of different methods. But it's really about this idea that the garden is dynamic. Landscapes are dynamic, as we know. We know here in the north that we've got four seasons and they are distinct. And so I think of our garden season, even though it's only maybe one or maybe two of those seasons, it's summer. For me, it's spring, summer, and fall. But it's got seasons within those seasons. And so succession planting is kind of celebrating and paying attention to these nuances and these seasons that we can have. And it's not only vegetables. It's not only thinking about, like, how can I stretch out my tomato harvest? For me, it's also about how can I stretch out my flowers? How can I ensure that pollinators, natives, and honeybees, everyone who's welcome here in my garden, which is all insects, unfortunately, because there's pests too here. But the idea is I want to make sure I have flowers as early as possible until as late as possible. Our apricot tree was the first thing to bloom this year. You know, we had a very early spring here in Minnesota. It's the first year it really bloomed in earnest. We had a few flowers in the past, but this year it profusely bloomed, and we maybe have about a dozen fruits, which is a first for us as gardeners. We've never eaten a homegrown apricot, so we're delighted. But it was covered in pollinators. The morning cloaks, native bees, the mason bees. This was early mid-April. So this succession planting is really about filling in every possible day, month, week of the gardening season with something for our wildlife to eat and something for us as well.
I was thinking about it, and the way that you constantly have material there, food for your family to eat from really early to really late. And I thought, oh my goodness me, how you would have a ton of food more than I would have in my garden, the way I've been planting it.
Okay, possibly. So one thing might be space. Our garden is kind of large. Maybe we should.
Tell me about your garden.
And there's lots of images in the book as well as on social media. So we left the city in 2016 to move out to land. And our garden is slightly larger than our Minneapolis entire lot was from curb to alley. Our house, our old house, our garage, the boulevard, the sidewalk, those could all fit inside our current garden. So for those of you who live in an urban, it's maybe 8,000 square feet that's fenced in. It's about between an eighth and a quarter of an acre. It's not quite a quarter acre, but that also includes our kind of bucolic red barn. We've got two patios within there. And this whole space was very intentionally fenced off before we planted anything. We put a deer fence that was also rabbit proof when we built the garden. They were initially raised or in-ground beds, and we transitioned to raised beds 3 seasons ago. So everything's raised beds now, and we have, I should know these numbers, Larry, but I knew last year, maybe 5,000 square feet in actual vegetable raised beds. Maybe it's more like 2,500. Maybe it's a total of like 5,000 square feet total. It's a lot. It's a lot. It's very intensively planted. And we grow more than we need or can consume. And the joy of that is being able to give food to neighbors and friends. And when we go places, doctor's appointments or haircuts or music lessons, I bring little mini CSAs to people. And that's kind of the joy of it too, is sharing it. And you know, being inspired, like, oh, wow, you have broccoli already. Well, of course I have broccoli in early June. This is how I garden, you know?
Well, I loved it. I wondered if you were into canning or food preservation in any way at all.
Absolutely. If you garden on this scale and you don't can, you're crazy. I mean, yes, I do. I grow all of our own tomatoes. We haven't bought a store-bought can of tomatoes in several years. It took me a few years to figure out how many tomato plants I need. I make ketchup. That's probably one of my favorite things to do with tomatoes, but it really takes a lot of reduction to get, you know, it's probably 100 pounds of tomatoes go into my, you know, couple of pounds of ketchup. So, but these are the joys of gardening, is that we can choose how we want to spend our time, right, with our food. And yeah, canning is for sure a big, big part of it for us.
And your background in natural resources, I think, kind of comes through in the writing. You talk about the relation, you know, learning from the forest land, for mm-hmm. example.
I didn't realize how much influence that had on me. And it was really this one very poignant moment. I was out east. I was born and raised in Southern Connecticut, and I was out visiting my parents, and I was walking by these woods. I can remember exactly where I was, and I saw sort of the edge that was on the south side of the road, and there were shrubs there. And it was the time when I was thinking about what kind of concept of a book I wanted to write about. And after doing research, I knew no one had written about succession planting. And I was like, okay, well, what about succession planting, right? Is this a whole book? And then I realized, like, every landscape that I love has some aspect that we apply to gardening, whether we know it or not. And that whole idea of the edge, and you think about the edges and, you know, how much can we shove underneath our tomato plants or near our tomato plants? Or if you've got vining crops, can you grow in the shade things like celery or cilantro or lettuce and things like that? And then the prairie too, which it took me a while to learn to love it, because I really am still very much enamored with the Pacific Northwest and the majestic forests out there and the rainforests. Yeah. That whole landscape it was just a really big part of my formative years, and it's still, I love it. But prairies, I learned to love them as much, which is saying a lot. It took me about 10 years being here. I've been here 21 years, about half the time I tried to love it, and now I really understand it and love it. And prairies are probably one of the most relatable things for people, I think, in the Midwest in terms of what they offer. They yeah. offer something to pollinators all season long. And as gardeners, we can think like, wow, I got my golden Alexanders in May and my penstemon in June and my, you know, pale purple coneflower in early July. What could that look like as vegetables, right? So, and paying attention to what landscapes you love and why you love them and why you love the seasons of them kind of could help all of us grow, I think, as better gardeners and better tenders of whatever bits yeah. of land we are lucky to garden. Yeah.
Most of the gardens you see, I mean, there's rows. There's a row of radishes, then there might be a row of onions, then there might be a row of something else. And you have some rows, I guess, but your philosophy is not necessarily we're going to plant all the same thing. You plant a bunch of things together. Let's put it that way.
Yes, and I do have, and yes, sometimes I interplant, and I do interplant a lot, and I think that's what you're referring to, is yeah. it's not just, I never just plant tomatoes. I'll do my, under my indeterminate tomatoes that I trellis right now, for instance, I've got some celery under there. I've got some head lettuce under there. I've got some marigolds this year instead of sweet alyssum. Next to my determinate tomatoes, I've got cilantro on the north and basil on the south because they're still very small. I'm playing with direct seeding, Larry. So I direct seed my determinate tomatoes now, and they're only about 6 inches tall. But I did this last year, and it worked. And I'm not getting any younger, so I'm trying to find ways to garden easier. And direct seeding is like my new little pet project of trying to see what I don't have to sow indoors.
Yeah.
But yes, there are some things that don't interplant well. You know, I don't really interplant my garlic. I keep that well tended. And onions too. Things, if you think about it, the easiest way to think about it, things that vine and grow tall, you can get away with planting something underneath because the plant, as long as it's low growing, because it's not going to compete for sunlight. But things that are shorter and stay shorter, like your onions and your garlic, my peanuts that I grow every year, things like, I don't even really interplant my peppers very much. I'll put flowers kind of at the ends of the beds, but things that stay a little shorter, they're going to struggle if you plant something with it. One of the worst examples was, tomatillos, which, you know, I know that they are ridiculously crazy. I planted a couple many years ago, and then I planted some nasturtium with them that I thought were mounding. Mm-hmm. And I think I referenced this in my book, and, they were not mounding, they were vining. And by the middle of August, it looked like a nasturtium hedge. And it was really hard to tell what the dominant plant was supposed to be because the nasturtium completely took over. So you have to be very careful with how you pair things together. Yeah, you know, but it is fun. I mean, why not? I love having the color in my garden. I love having the insects with me. I love having the monarchs and the swallowtails and the goldfinches come in. And I just love the visiting my garden as a visitor alongside insects, if that makes sense. That's just a real important part of my gardening philosophy.
Well, I do like your writing. You have a wonderful writing style and the wonderful photos and absolutely wonderful illustrations in the book. But maybe just before we go any further, just to lay out how plant, grow, harvest, repeat, what we have in your book.
Yeah, so this book starts at the landscape level, and I introduce the idea of succession planting in the first chapter, and I give these parallels, as we talked about a few minutes earlier, to prairies and forests and kind of how the season works and really try to set the reader up for imagining a garden as as something that is constantly in flux. That's how I see succession planting, is you have to be okay with reaching for seeds any day. As I say somewhere in the book, I say, you know, succession gardening is the opposite of a plant it one day garden. It really is. And I have gaps in my garden still. We are June 14th. I have a couple of pockets in my garden that I haven't planted yet. And it's kind of by design because I like to stagger things out. And so in the book, I go on to, I frame succession planting in several ways. I talk about different ways that you can do it, whether blocking was what I just kind of talked about with the garlic and the onions, things that you want to kind of contain together. I talk about staggering your succession. So the easiest example and relatable would be planting paste tomatoes and cherry tomatoes and beefsteaks. Those are all going to kind of come into season at various times. So they will be staggered across time. So you're looking at that's a kind of a temporal way. And then you've got continuous planting, which is kind of what I'm doing right now. I set up some soil blocks this morning. I'm going to be sowing some beets and fennel and cabbage and cauliflower for fall once I get off air here. So that's, and then I also talk about season extending. And that's a really important part for us in northern climates, which is that we can gain weeks, pretty much a couple of months to our growing season if we really consider putting up just little hoops in our garden. And then the rest of the book really talks about applying that. So I go into perennial edibles and talk about kind of how they are a succession. You know, strawberries mature very quickly, but pears are kind of the old growth, or hazelnuts are even more old growth of edibles. And I talk about native edibles as well as cultivated. I go into vegetables and I talk about different vegetables, and I talk about how they are in succession. And so I talk about the season as early, kind of mid and late. And that's really, again, time. It's how much time vegetables are taking to mature. So the early ones are things like cilantro and arugula and spinach and radishes, just kind of garden fast food, if you will. And then you get into kind of 1 to 2 month time frame, then you get into 3 month, and then you get way like 4 to 5 or maybe even longer in the case of, say, garlic, which we all, some of us, I shouldn't say we all know, takes, you know, about 10 months to mature. And then I talk about interplanting. And then throughout the book, I also have kind of charts and diagrams to break out what you could sow when by season to help gardeners explore the idea of getting the most out of their garden.
Meg McAndrews Cowden, our guest today. Meg McAndrews Cowden is author of the book Plant, Grow, Harvest, Repeat. Questions for her as we move along today? Maybe you've got a garden question, maybe a general garden question. Maybe you have a question about succession gardening, or maybe you're doing it already. I'd love to hear what you've, what experiences you're having with it. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mailer for Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio News. Glad to have you with us for Garden Talk. Larry Mailer here with my guest, Meg McAndrews Cowden. Her book is titled Plant, Grow, Harvest, Repeat. And questions for her, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk at WPR.org. That's talk at WPR.org. Love to hear from you. I'll tell you what, let's take some calls. Sherry and Trigo, what's on your mind?
Oh, hi.
Get you right on here, Sherry. What do you have for us?
Right. I love hearing what I'm hearing about this gal writing this book and her love of gardening and getting the most out of your garden. And I do similar things. And I believe in that intensive gardening approach where you don't just put one plant in one bed, but others that they grow like companion planting. But I'm wondering, I'm in growing zone 3. So I'm wondering about the book. I'm thinking about buying it, but I'm wondering if she considers a really short growing season. I mean, we have about June, July, August, September, about 4 months of good, you know, quality summer kind of weather. But so that's my question. Does
sure.
the book address, you know,
address those growing zones? Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for the call. And that's a really great question. Yes. So all of my growing charts, all of my sowing charts, instead of saying when I sow them, I intentionally set it with how many weeks before my last frost so people could adjust accordingly. I would say the trick is less in the spring for a zone 3, and it might be more in the fall because you're even a little more punctuated on the fall end. So, you know, if I'm trying to grow storage cabbages for the fall, I would start those, let's say, in the third week of May. Theoretically, this year I missed the ball, so I'm doing faster maturing cabbages for the fall this year. But you might have to start those before your last frost then. But I will say that this book has been purchased and applied and adored tons of people in Canada and Manitoba and farther north use it. A very good friend in Charleston, South Carolina uses it and raves about my sowing charts. So I tried to make this not just a northern book for northern zones, although I will say that I hear from a lot of people that appreciate following me because so many gardening accounts online are from warmer climates. But yes, I think there's plenty here. And I really tried to make, you know, all the perennials to be zone 3 hardy when I could. So even like a lot of the edible perennials I talk about and things like that. So I would say there's plenty of information in there that would be really useful for you and your garden.
So in a zone 3, now, Sherry, when did you say that you start? I mean, what's your growing season for you? I mean,
well, I also have I'm 60 years old, and I related when she says, I don't have many years left. I count my summers, and I think, okay. But it's funny, you know, oh, God holds, you know, our lives in his hands. But I start a lot of seeds indoors, you know, and I haven't gotten broccoli in to where it where I can harvest in the spring yet. But I am trying to focus more on a fall harvest, like she was saying. So a fall harvest. And I'm actually going to direct sow, which I've never done direct sowing broccoli, but I'm going to try doing that like now to see, you know, what's going to come of it in the fall. Because broccoli doesn't like it. A lot of times it will bolt when it's too hot.
Yeah.
So yeah. Can I chime in here? Okay, Sherry, you got a couple things going on that I want to talk about. So I'm all for this direct seeding broccoli. I think it's great. I have direct seeded brassicas in the summer and they've worked out well. If things are bolting, I might play with other varieties. A lot of the broccoli I grow, I almost grow strictly heat tolerant broccoli, because just because it's a heat tolerant variety doesn't mean it won't do well when it's cooler too, if that makes sense. So a variety like Bellstar, it's a hybrid, but it's kind of a tried and true. I can get it sometimes to produce side shoots into August. I'm just cutting my first heads now. Those were sowed indoors in the end of February. They were transplanted on April 9th when my soil temperatures were about 50 degrees under a low tunnel. I think you could totally do a spring broccoli if you wanted. It would take a little bit of season extending and putting up a low tunnel, which, if that's too much work for you, I completely respect that, because I get that we all have different seasons of kind of our gardening careers. But I would be so curious to hear how the broccoli direct seeding goes. I've done it for the spring and with cabbages and kohlrabi and bok choy and things like that, and it's been great. So
and you might mention your site again for somebody like Sherry might want to let you know.
Sure. So you can follow me online at Seed to Fork on Instagram, and my website is the same name, seedtofork.com.
Sherry, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. And you mentioned, what did you say, trench or?
Did I say?
There was a term you used that that was something like trench. And I thought, well, somebody's going to want to know what the heck that is.
I don't remember talking. I don't know what I said, but well, we're going to loop back to it when we both remember.
Well, you'll say it again, and then I'll say, wait a minute, stop right there.
Okay.
So it was a way of, I think, planting earlier to get around.
The frost. So yeah. It might have been a cold frame or a low tunnel, Larry.
Low tunnel. What's a low tunnel?
So a low tunnel, I use just 10-foot electric metal conduits, or you can use PVC pipes, and I just bend them into a hoop. It's like a mini greenhouse. Gives you about 4 feet of height in your bed. You can drop them just directly into the ground if you have in-ground beds, and use rebar, put rebar into the ground and bend those pipes right over to those, and the rebar is kind of sleeves in. And then I use either 6 mil painter's poly, or if you want to go the extra mile, you buy some greenhouse poly, which lasts a little longer and is a little it's more translucent, more transparent. Mm-hmm. And then you use different kinds of clips to fashion that down, and that I put that up in the middle of February, and my soil temperatures inside there by early March are usually warm enough to plant, and I'll start direct seeding in there by the second week in March.
You've got a great, you actually have a great photo in there with snow on them.
Yeah. Often I'll have to shovel out to get the poly on, and I consider snow shoveling at the beginning of my gardening season in a way, you know, shoveling snow in the garden.
Oh, man. Sherry, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Heather in Brooklyn will go to you next. Brooklyn, Wisconsin. Hi, Heather.
Hi, Larry and Meg. Hello to you both. I consider both of you some of my garden mentors, so it's very nice to talk to you today.
Well, thank you.
Hi, Heather. I know Heather.
Yes. So I'm a little bit south of Madison, and I just wanted to kind of expand on what I can do with an extra zone warmer than Meg. And over the past couple of years, I have been experimenting with cold frame growing. So I definitely took a lot of inspiration from Meg, but the digging out the cold frames in February wasn't so appealing to me. So I put polycarbonate frames over the top of my garden beds that are already in the ground. And I plant pretty much an entire bed of very cold tolerant lettuces and spinach and herbs and alliums in about August and September. And that allows us to be harvesting salad greens all the way through the winter, just south of Madison. And I don't think people really realize that we are capable of year-round growing in our area.
So you do it year-round, Heather. Wow.
Yeah. I think we really push ourselves because I really want salad greens in the winter, and I really don't like buying them. So.
Oh, thank you so much for calling. I love that. And if Heather can do it.
Exactly. Yeah, Heather's a great example. She shares a lot of her trials with me and her successes. And yes, I think she makes a great point that she's motivated and curious. And I will say, unlike Sherry and maybe myself, she is on the younger side. So she has energy in some ways to really push her season. But I think we all need to be curious with the changing climate of what is realistic for us. And one thing I do, Heather covers it, I plant spinach on the fall equinox. This is like, if someone thinks I'm crazy and this is too much gardening, Larry, this is like one of the easier things to do is I plant spinach on the fall equinox here. I'm in zone 4. Maybe if you're in zone 3, maybe you want to plant it on September 1st. I maybe get a harvest. I get true leaves. I get a couple of sets of true leaves before the hard freeze. I don't touch it. I don't cover it. Like you had mentioned, she covers hers. I just let it sit in the garden. I forget about it. Usually the snow covers it. This year it didn't for very long, so I was a little worried about it. But I am harvesting spinach in March and April, and I planted it. And it's super easy because the garden's empty. So if you love spinach, go for it. Fill a whole bed with it. It's going to bolt sometime in May, which is going to be just in time to drop your tomatoes or your peppers, your potatoes or corn in there. So it's a really nice way of stretching out the season and sort of a lazy way to do it. I think it's great.
And you have another ritual that I really liked a lot, and that involves the first day of spring.
Yep. I always plant seeds on the first day of spring. And it has changed over the years. It was the equinox radish for a while there that I would usually harvest by the end of April. And these, again, are under this low tunnel. So this tunnel that I end up stuffing with a lot of brassicas, there's always room. You know, my brassicas are pretty small, so I've got 18 inches or more between those rows of brassicas that's soil. And so that's where I put those 30-day to 40-day crops in there that are going to come out before the cabbages and broccoli get too big. So yeah, I really like marking time like that. And it makes it sort of fun and almost easier in a way to get behind. If you're someone who maybe procrastinates, which I know it's hard to believe, but I am quite a procrastinator. So these rituals help me stay on track.
Questions for Meg, maybe what's going on in your garden right now? Or maybe you have a question about succession gardening. I hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Let's talk about, you know, kind of the step approach here a little bit. In order to have a successful succession garden, the first step is to plant well, you say.
Yeah.
How do you start that plan?
Well, I think the best planned garden is making sure you're growing food that you really want to eat.
Yeah.
And that, you know, is going to grow well for your zone. So there were a few years there where I kind of lost my way and was swayed by the online images of colorful vegetables and, you know, the alluring marketing of seed catalogs. But I've gotten a little stronger willed and a little clearer, right, in terms of, okay, I don't know. Right now, I am on a spice kick, and I wanna grow my own mustard seed for my own pickles. So I've set aside space to grow Dijon mustard seeds this year. So I think that's part of it. And I think like, for example, I know people who grow like a half a dozen summer squash, and I think they're absolutely bananas. I mean, I grow one or two summer squash plants, and even with that, I end up pulling one of them out by the middle of August and replanting it with root crops or something for the fall. So, and you got to be really careful about your space too. So I think one of the biggest things that people go wrong, especially young gardeners, is they try to put too much in. If your plant is little, you think you should put it close to the next little plant you're planting it with. Whereas you have to really think about maturity and how large plants are going to get. My plants get very large because we have really great sun aspect, long, like 12 hours of sun in the height of summer in our garden. And there's no trees, so there's no tree roots creeping in. And so plants just flourish. And thank goodness for the rain. Are you guys getting rain in Wisconsin this spring?
Oh,
we are getting
yes.
rain like every other day.
Yes, we are.
I mean, I tell myself I'm never complaining about rain again after those three dry years, but maybe in a few years, if it's still raining this much, I will. But yeah. And then, you know, the other thing about that garden plan and for succession planting is try to plant something that's going to create a gap. So I think garlic or that spinach that I mentioned, like planting something in the fall that will create a gap sometime in the growing season, that's a great entry point for succession planting. I gave a talk out in Western Minnesota a few years ago, and I was talking about getting your fall garden going. I was talking in the end of July, and I asked people, you know, what do you guys do when your peas are done? And they're like, we just leave them. And I just about fell over. I was like, there's so much opportunity. So, and you know, even locally, I'll see people who do, you know, their row of cabbages, their row of tomatoes, you know, it's kind of the garden's kind of even further out. We're kind of on the edge of country out here in the West Metro of Minneapolis. And I'm thinking, wow, they could replant that. So think about replanting things. I also love to rip out my cucumbers, my pickling cucumbers. Once I've got my, you know, 12 to 20 quarts of pickles for the year, I'm sorry, I don't need to harvest any more pickles. I don't need to give them away. So I pull it all out and I plant that with either kohlrabi, Napa cabbage, watermelon radish, quick lettuces, something 50 days or quicker to maturity. So it's this constant playing of like how many weeks before my last frost or my first frost in that case in the fall. I'm constantly assessing, right? Like what seeds can I play with?
And you have a description of the different kinds of successions and what kinds of vegetables, and maybe talk a bit about that. There are different types of succession, different kinds of vegetables you can grow during each type.
Right, right. So you've got your fast maturing, your early succession plants, which I consider sort of 40 days or less. And those are a lot of your leafy greens and radishes, mostly, and some quick herbs like cilantro. And then you've got your sort of mid-season succession. So those things take about 2 months to mature. And then you've got, so those are kind of a lot of like our, I mean, they take 2 months to mature, but I also consider some of those you need to start indoors. So like, you know, your tomatoes are 70 days to mature, but you also need a couple of months, that lead up time. Same with peppers and eggplants. Things like beets would be in that section too, as well as brassicas. Corn as well, a lot of things, beans. I think of that as kind of our main kind of what a traditional garden would be.
Sure.
Right. Two to three months. And then you've got your late season or kind of your long season succession. And those are how I phrase them. So leeks, garlic, onions, Brussels sprouts, things that are taking 4 or more months. And those things, oh, and also winter squash, also dry corn, popcorn, made dried beans are faster, but things that the space won't turn over in the garden, right? So I kind of think of those as my architectural pieces for the garden, the growing season. So wherever I stake space for those, I'm not going to succession plant in those places, right? Like, I'm not going to be harvesting my summer squash in late September and planting something there. I could plant spinach, I guess, but I don't usually. But the spaces where we can succession plant are that early season and a lot of those mid-season successions. So I love to plant more than one succession of snap beans, bush beans. When your peas come out, that's a great place to succession plant behind it. And there's another category I have is generalist successions. And these really are a northern climate variety, yeah. Right? This is where my book speaks to the northern climate, because I have a friend down in North Carolina who, when she saw my garden a couple of years ago, could not believe how beautiful my brassicas were. And she had total brassica envy. And so to all your listeners who, like, you know, feel like we don't have it good up here, we are built to grow brassicas. You know, they're endemic to, you know, northern Europe, which is even further north than we are latitude wise. So we can all just celebrate the brassica, but not the cabbage white butterfly. So brassicas, carrots and beets are what I call kind of generalist successions, in that I can grow them in the spring, I can grow them in the summer, and I can grow them in the fall. They're cold tolerant and they're heat tolerant, they're frost hardy. And those are kind of your pocket succession planting friends, I would say. If you don't like beets, whatever, don't grow them. But carrots, who doesn't love a garden carrot? So those are the things that I reach for most often when I'm getting ready to succession plant, to keep that in production.
And if you don't like beets, you should try grilling them.
Oh, just so good. Pickling them. I do love a pickled beet.
Oh, I do too. Our guest today, Meg McAndrews Cowden. Her book is called Plant, Grow, Harvest, Repeat. Great to have her with us. And you can join in too. The number to call, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Great to have you along for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Meg McAndrews Cowden, and her book is titled Plant, Grow, Harvest, Repeat. She also has Instagram and a website, and just go to Seed to Fork for that. Seed to Fork is where you need to go to get to her Instagram and to her website, which she's got lots of good information there. Questions, join in, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Let's talk a little bit more about interplanting. Yeah, what are some do's and don'ts? You've just maybe talk a little more about some of the do's and don'ts connected with that.
Yeah, that's a great question. You got to make sure, I like to think, and this gets back to that first chapter in the book where I talk about landscapes, Larry, every space in our garden has an overstory and potentially an understory if we're interplanting it. And an overstory is sort of, think of that as the highest point in any bed in your garden. It would be the tallest trees on your property. If you're lucky enough to have trees, if you have a piece of land that has trees on it, that's your overstory. Your understory is what grows kind of in the shade or what grows below it. So I think of kind of our gardens as almost mini forests, right? So my tomatoes are my overstory. And if I can get something underneath them, that's my understory. And so you want to make sure you're pairing different heights together. I don't take it as far as companion planting, and I'm not looking for plants that maybe aren't using the same, pulling the same nutrients out of the soil. I don't go that far. I really look more for aesthetics when I interplant, so I do a lot of flower interplanting. But not all flowers can be interplanted. So flowers are probably the biggest thing I interplant with. I do greens. I do cilantro as vegetables, radishes in the early season. I'll sometimes run beets, interplant beets. It can be dicey. I've tried to put beets next to squash, and 2 weeks later, the squash has shaded out the beets, things like that. So even I can falter at this interplanting when it's vegetables and vegetables. But when it's vegetables and flowers, you almost can't go wrong as long as you're choosing low growing. So I love Tiny Tim is like kind of an extra small sweet alyssum. I think alyssum is a fantastic addition to any garden. Our garden is covered with hoverflies from May all the way through the end of the year. And hoverflies are voracious predators, you know, in their larval stages. It's completely invisible to my eye, but I know that I've got a large population of them, and it's great. I love nasturtium to interplant too, but that's kind of a little bigger. I also love gem marigolds. Those also can get a little on the tall side, so that's why I put them this year under my tomatoes, because I prune my tomatoes up, you know, a good 12 to 18 inches to prevent some splashing. And in these cases, so in the case of maybe interplanting flowers under your tomatoes, it's also acting as a living mulch. So it can keep the soil a little cooler, keep some weeds at bay, and then also hopefully prevent splashing, which is where so many soil-borne fungi can jump up onto the stems of our plants. So it's better than mulch, in my opinion, because it's beautiful and it brings in more insects. So I do talk about things. Zinnia, I don't really interplant. I'll interplant them with other flowers. I'll interplant them with ornamentals, like I grow artichokes in our garden. This is my second year growing them. I like to interplant them with kale and things like that, things that I tend to be more ornamental vegetables. I'm sure I'm forgetting something. Snapdragons, I think, are kind of a little easier to interplant because they don't produce as much leaf area. And this is where I'm getting into my forestry background. But leaf area is the area that leaves occupy kind of in any given plane. If you think of, if you took a slice across your garden and you looked down on it, how much space the leaves occupy is your leaf area. So if we compare, a good example in my book is I pair cosmos with cucumbers. And if you look at the frilly foliage of cosmos, it's practically invisible, right? It's very frondy. It's very light. Yeah. It's never going to be a thug next to my cucumbers. And so I get the flowers and the whimsy of these beautiful plants, the flowering plants, next to my hardworking vegetable. And so that's a really nice combination of two taller plants. And it's really one of the only places I will put a taller growing flower next to a vegetable.
Well, here you are talking about cucumbers on National Cucumber Day. Jeff Robbins, our technical director, reminded me.
Oh, happy National Cucumber Day, everyone.
Oh, Mike in Coon Valley has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Mike.
Hello. I took some soil out of the ditch next to the roadway in front of our house rather than having the county dig their trench. And I used that to fill up a raised bed that I acquired. And I'm going to amend it with some organic material around whatever I plant. But what would be the best vegetable to plant in a spot like that?
And there's a lot of sand involved in that, Mike?
Yeah, it's what, you know, the township spreads a lot of sand, and over the years it accumulated in there. But it's a, you know, it's sandy. Let's put it that way.
Mm. Not total, but so it's a sandy type soil. Okay.
One thing I would recommend is maybe get it soil tested too, so you know. Yeah. If it's really sandy soil, I mean, I just think getting a soil tested, I don't know how sensitive you are to potentially having chemicals that might have been in there. Sandy soil things I think of immediately for planting would be potatoes or carrots, which both really like looser soil. But if it's sandy, I would be very generous with adding compost to it. And so, I mean, I'm talking, don't hold back. 6 inches of compost, mix it in, go for it if it's really that sandy. sand is great, except nutrients don't stay in it. Our soils tend to be heavier here where we are, so they're more clay, which is nice, but it also means the water doesn't move through as fast. But water moving through, Mike, means it's going to take something with it. So that's where really you can't, I don't think you can throw too much compost on sandy soil.
No, I think that's really good advice, Mike. Good luck with that, and just keep doing it every year too with the mulch and working it into your soil. I think that would be a very good thing to do. A bunch of questions here, emails. Gloria in Franklin wondered what variety of peas you like to plant and where you get your seeds. Where do you?
Oh, those are two good questions. I really love to grow I stagger my pea succession, which hopefully makes sense. I did this before I even knew I was doing it. So we've always grown snow peas and snap peas, and they're about 10 days apart in how they produce. So I grow sugar and snap peas. And then we grow Oregon giant snow peas. And I was gifted this year seeds from Row 7 Seeds, and they are a purple potted snow pea, excuse me, called the Beauregard. So I'm growing that too. And then we also generally, I ran out of seed this year, so I had to punt and run to the garden center. But I have really enjoyed PLS 595. I think that's what it was called. It's a pea variety, a very boring name. I don't know who named it. But those pea seeds were from Johnny's Seeds. So my seed buying really varies. And if I'm going to buy hybrids, and I do buy a lot of my brassicas are hybrids. Things like watermelons are often hybrids. I'm trying seedless watermelons for the first time this year. A lot of those seeds I buy from Johnny's. But then after that, I've been really spreading my net far and wide. I love adaptive seeds out of Western Oregon. They're out of Sweet Home, Oregon. And they do they're part of this open source seed initiative, which, not to go too far off the rails here, Larry, but it's just a really cool thing. And they've brought back varieties of things that are no longer sold because of hybrids. So it's like the antithesis to Johnny's in a way. I have two very successful cabbages that I grow from them. Premax is a green cabbage and Chieftain is a Savoy. And I've always thought to myself, well, I don't know, no one sells open pollinated cabbages. It must be because, like, I don't know why. And it's just, it's really, I think it's kind of more of a sales thing than the fact that we can't grow them. These cabbages performed really well in my garden. And it really has me starting to rethink how many hybrids I grow. I love Botanical Interests, which I can pick up a lot locally. Driftless Seed is out of, I guess it would be Southwest Wisconsin, out of the Driftless region. They're kind of a younger seed company, and they also specialize in open pollinated and kind of regionally adapted seeds. So they're a great company to check out. I've got some of their seeds this year. And Siskiyou Seeds in Southern Oregon. I shop kind of all over. I think there is a blog post in my garden resource library on my website of the different seed companies I enjoy supporting and kind of my reasoning.
Well, you go all over the place, and why not?
Totally, it feels good to support. Especially a lot of these seed companies are really small outfits, and so I like the idea of spreading my dollars around to different companies. It just feels good to support as many farmers as I can.
Our guest today, Meg McAndrews Cowden. Her book is called "Plant, Grow, Harvest, Repeat." We're talking succession planning with her. Vivian in Deerfield, Illinois, hope you hang on here. We're going to take a look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back with our guest. Great to have you with us for Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here on WPR News, and we're talking about ways to lengthen your growing season on the show today. And our guest, Meg McAndrews-Cowden, is author of the book Plant, Grow, Harvest, Repeat. She's a self-taught organic gardener, advanced degree in natural resource management. You can follow her on Instagram. And I made a mistake on the title of the Instagram account a few minutes ago, so let me make sure I have it right. It's Seed to Fork. That's the title of her Instagram account, Seed to Fork. So what would you like to know about succession planning? What's going on in your own garden you have questions about? Give us a call. Number's 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk at WPR.org. That's talk at WPR.org. Samantha in Galesville called wondering if you have any advice for planting a garden where there are a lot of pine trees.
Oh, pine trees. Well, I mean, what I like to tell people is that, you know, you think about farms and you think about how many trees do you see in a cornfield, or how many trees are there when you're picking blueberries or strawberries? I don't and have not done a lot of gardening under trees except native flowers, native shrubs, and things like that. I think being away from the drip line would be the best bet. But I've also seen gardens, and I've had gardeners, even master gardeners in Minnesota, who have, you know, applied my book to their garden and are like, man, my garden just doesn't look as good as yours. And I go to their house and their garden beds are right in front of their birch trees and their maple trees. And you think those trees, those fine tree roots are, you better believe they're going to come up and into your garden beds if they are within the drip line of your garden. So I would say embrace your beautiful pine trees and look at edible shrubs and things like that rather than going for full on vegetables. I don't know. What do you think, Larry?
No, I think that's, like, yeah, I agree 100%, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
We can leave it at that. Vivian in Deerfield, Illinois wondered, how far apart do you set, how do you set the veggies, the companion plants with the veggies? I mean, how far apart are they and such?
Yeah, so I follow my, I've got a kind of a minimum plant spacing guideline in my book. And so I kind of follow that. So let's take tomatoes, which I always interplant, and I've talked about it a couple of times this hour. I plant my vining tomatoes about 28 inches apart, and I'm pruning them to 3 liters, only 3 liters. And underneath them, I'm going to drop my basil or my marigolds or my lettuce. I'm going to space those, whatever that would be, 6 inches apart from my alyssum. And that goes right up and next to that tomato plant because I know that it's going to sit in the understory. So it is a little bit specific to the varieties, but if I am giving my overstory plant the proper spacing, which I'm generous, I'm more generous than some people. I do 3 feet between one determinate tomato plant. We've tried to plant them closer and harvesting them has been a mess. Well, last year we tried 30 inches apart and it was still, I'm going 3 feet this year and it might be too much space. But there is a lot of empty space in that bed right now. And that's why I'm putting things like cilantro and basil just right on the edge. So it really takes time. And I think the thing I want to encourage your listeners to really consider is that my gardening experiences really happens in real time. And that's how my knowledge was accumulated. And I think the best thing we can do is try and learn and take notes, take pictures, and make changes next year. That's the joy of gardening, is this kind of slow drip of knowledge for me. And I wouldn't want to rush it for anyone else either, really.
Liz in Madison was wondering, she has powdery mildew in her delphiniums.
Well, I'd say there's, if it's already there, there's not much you can do about it. Consider, I don't know, Larry, I don't have a lot of, I don't really get powdery mildew in my garden. So I know there's home remedies for it. I think plant spacing and air circulation is a good preventative measure. but because it's fungal, if you let it ride there, those spores are probably going to drop down and it's going to continue to possibly be an issue, especially if you're not maybe mulching heavily enough.
You're probably not getting it because of your spacing.
I think that's probably part of it. And sunshine, too, if this is in part shade, maybe. I mean, I think of powdery mildew comes on for me sometimes very slightly in my winter squash later in the season, though, like really late. And I actually think for me, it's worse when it's hot and dry, which really hurts my brain because I think mildew moist, but yeah. It somehow seems to manifest really in like the late heat of summer for me, but not everywhere. And you're right. My plants have a lot of space. So maybe consider thinning some of them out. I'm not sure. I'm sorry to say I don't have a great prescription for that one.
Yeah. Susan in Duluth, Minnesota, emailed to ask about Dolgo crabapple fruit clusters. You know Dolgo? D-O-L-G-O.
I don't know this crabapple. But yeah. Is she asking about thinning?
Would you reduce those fruit clusters like you would with larger apples?
Yeah, for sure. If this is a crab apple variety for eating, I definitely would reduce it. Maybe a couple per cluster. Since on some trees, like on our Harrelson, we'll reduce it down to one fruit every 6 inches or so. And that produces some really nice big fruit.
Yeah, she was wondering about spacing. That makes a lot of sense.
To
me as well. You know, one of the fun things I noticed in your book had to do with Yukon gold potatoes, but it was about Yukon gold potatoes. But it was what it was really about was letting things go or changing your mind about things.
Yeah, I think this is where the garden is a really nice lens for us to apply sort of life's metaphors. I love Yukon gold potatoes. I have not grown them since maybe 2019 because they were so disease prone in our garden. So I have found so many other great gold potatoes that I love and that actually even they grow better and they store better. So huckleberry gold is a different kind of gold fleshed potato, but it's the last one we eat. We don't start eating it until April because it stores so well. And we probably even still have a few in our fridge. You know, we put the last 20, 25, 30 pounds in our fridge in May because they were starting to sprout. We keep them in a root cellar up until then with passive cooling. But yes, this idea that we have to reconsider sometimes what we're in a relationship with or maybe in real life, who? I mean, but yes, it having to let go of plants, it has happened to me more than once.
About just pulling them out and all right, so you got little, really small potatoes, but you ate them anyway, but you planted something else in their place, right? Kind of in the middle of the season.
Yeah, that probably might have been one of the earlier times when I really thought, creating a gap in August or July is actually not a detriment to the garden season. It's a benefit. Yeah. So don't be afraid to pull stuff out if it's not working for you. Even if there's something you don't like how it tastes, like why keep growing it just because it's growing? It's your garden. You can completely restart your garden any day of the growing season.
Mark emailed to ask how you deal with pests in your garden. What are the pests you have and how do you deal with them?
Yeah, well, it varies week to week and season to season. I do a lot of hand picking. I try to be good about monitoring. It's a pretty large garden. I find the pests really do change every year. For example, you know, we've had some mild winters now up here, and I expected cucumber beetles in 2023 to be voracious. And I really didn't see any until about September, which I thought was very puzzling. Cabbage loopers seem to cycle. They're terrible for me this year. The slugs are awful because of the rain. If we use things, we really use organic or biological pesticides. So we use BT, Bacillus thuringiensis, for things like caterpillars. I'll use Sluggo, so the iron phosphate, and to deal with slugs. Haven't spread any yet. Kind of like the idea of the insects coming in and kind of taking care of things. I have tons of parasitic wasps that come in, and familiar bluets will start you know, feeding on my asparagus beetle larvae. I mean, there's definitely an aspect of an ecosystem approach, but there are times, I mean, BT is about as exciting as we get. And we also try to do preventative things. So especially for fungal diseases, we apply something called CEASE, which is another bacillus. It's another bacteria, but this sort of creates a probiotic, like a sort of a positive microbiome on leaves of your plants to try and deter and prevent spores from populating. So we've sprayed them on our tomatoes and our cucumbers, as well as on our fruit trees to try and prevent things like cedar apple rust.
Jan was wondering if you consider edible flowers at all, or do you, you know, grow flowers in your garden with the idea of eating?
Yes. Yes. I almost all of the flowers in our garden are edible, actually. Larkspur is probably the only one that's technically not edible. You know, I think even zinnia are edible, although I don't eat them. The gem marigolds are delicious. I love eating them. I love inviting my garden guests to eat them. Nasturtium, calendula are great, and they're great dried, and they're a great herb. So a lot of I don't use them often. Say nasturtium and gem marigolds are probably the ones we use the most. And if it's a good year, I'll make the time to dry my calendula. Sometimes I'll get chamomile popping up, and I'll save that for drying for tea. But that's a real heavy self-seeder, so I don't plant it anymore. But if it shows up, I might let it flower.
And you mentioned honeyberries in your book, and I noticed on Garden Talk over the last year, couple of years, there have been more questions asked about them, and more people are considering them.
Yeah.
And you talk about them. Why do you grow them? And tell a little bit about honeyberries.
Well, at the time of writing that book, we actually had no honeyberries on our property, and that was 2020. And at the time of talking to you right in this very moment, I think we have 10 honeyberry shrubs on our property, or maybe it's only 8. We transitioned our raspberry bed to honeyberries because our raspberries just didn't produce well in the fall, and they were fighting with Japanese beetles. And this is, again, kind of like the potatoes, Larry. It's like, we got to break up with the raspberries. This is just not working for us. So we don't have any cultivated raspberries on our property. We have black caps, you know, on the edges of the woods all around us here on our property. And my husband planted 6 of them last year, and we have a lot of honeyberries that are coming into season. Now, all the talk about honeyberries says they're, I think in my book I say they're around the same time as strawberries, which feels a little better than the marketing says they come in before strawberries. And I'm calling that fake news because ours are not fully ripe yet. And a lot of my followers who are subscribers to my Modern Garden Guild, some of them are farther along the honeyberry path than I am. And they say, you got to wait for them to almost shrivel up. For years, I ate them when they weren't quite ripe. And they taste a little bit like a huckleberry to me, but I think I'm eating them even a little unripe. So they're supposed to be not white at all on the inside when they're fully ripe, and sort of flat and almost even shriveled up a little. They seem highly productive. Our plan is to freeze them. My husband eats a protein smoothie every day, and he does blueberries and strawberries, homegrown strawberries, homegrown honeyberries, and we're going to call it a day. Because, you know, our soils are very alkaline here, and it takes us a lot of effort to keep our blueberry plants happy. And if we could learn to love honeyberries, I don't know, would we get rid of our blueberries? Probably not, but it sort of takes a little bit of the pressure off. So yeah. I'm also, though, I'm a little cautious about them, though, Larry, because it's like, oh, well, they're related to honeysuckles. Like, how much do we really know? Are they going to escape gardens? And in 20 years, are they going to become the next invasive species? I think no, but I also, you know, I'm proceeding with caution, right? Like,
yeah. But there's been a lot more interest just because it's so hard to grow blueberries in most.
Totally.
You just got to keep amending the soil all of the time.
No, there's so much work. Our soil is over 7. Our water that comes out of our spigot is like 7.5. I mean, our water's alkaline. So we have my husband started hand watering the blueberries with like a dilute vinegar. He adds vinegar to a gallon of water to make it acidic water for the blueberries.
Ah, does it work?
Well, they're looking a little better. Last year, the leaves were looking really red. But now that it's raining so much, it's also kind of a non-issue, right? Because we're not irrigating anymore. Rainwater is definitely not as alkaline as our well water. So
yeah. So what methods, and this is another question from a listener, what methods do you use to keep your soil healthy?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you
Good
grow
question.
A lot in that soil, yeah. and that you're pulling a lot of nutrients out of that ground.
We are. I'm putting them in our belly. I'm a big, big proponent of being generous with top dressing with compost. So our beds are probably initially 50% compost, 50% kind of garden blend soil. We did some amending, not to run down a rabbit hole, when we initially made the in-ground beds. But on top of knowing that we put a lot of organic matter in from the beginning, I swear by the slow release organic fertilizer recipe that's in my book. It is a generalist. It's slow release. You're not going to burn your plants. I mix it right into the planting holes. I'll top dress it sometimes around plants, things like maybe my peppers or my tomatoes mid-season. So it really takes the microbial life to make those nutrients bioavailable to plants. So I'm a firm believer in adding nutrients. And we also add about 2 inches of compost on top of every bed every fall. And that also, I don't mix it in. So it's, I consider it my mulch. And the soil microbial life and the, you know, all of the organisms that dwell in our raised beds will pull it down, and mix it in over the growing season. So, yes. And I do try to not repeat. I do not repeat the same vegetable in the same bed in the same season. So that is to say, where my brassicas are growing right now, I'm going to put my late succession of edamame and carrots there for the fall. I wouldn't put my fall brassicas on top of brassicas. That's too much depletion. But I do sometimes, usually, take the same beds and do the spring brassicas on those because they're the farthest north and they're the ones that warm up the quickest. But tomatoes and potatoes, I really try to not. They have not repeated a place in our garden yet.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm trying. It's not easy. I mean, I'm about ready to. That doesn't mean they're disease-free, but those plants and cucumbers I try to move around too, because those can also tend to be the plants that you get fungal diseases on. Those are the ones that I'm most worried about crop rotating. But
How do you use cover crops? Do you use cover crops?
I use them a little bit. I mostly really love buckwheat as a cover crop because it kind of falls in that early succession bucket. So I use it to hold space for my fall brassicas so that I honestly don't forget to plant the whole, so I don't plant the whole garden so that, well, actually, so that I do plant the whole garden, but I'm holding space. So my buckwheat is going to be flowering here soon, which means it'll be out right around a little bit after the 4th of July, at which time hopefully my seeds that I'm planting today for that garden will be in pretty good shape to be transplanted into there. But other than that, I don't do a lot of cover cropping. We've done peas and oats. Those are also great. That's about it. I rely on compost for nutrient replenishment.
Somebody else had a question about seeds, and back to what we were talking about, seeds and seed packets and so mm-hmm. forth. That you get some that are just that are labeled wet wildflowers. What are we getting there?
Oh, you're getting something that I would not plant. I have a whole little. I think I have a sidebar in my flower chapter. I talk about flowers and I talk about the difference between natives and wildflowers. And I think a wildflower seed mix, if you don't know enough about gardening, I would not recommend planting those. There can be oxeye daisies in some of those, which are, you know, an invasive species. I would really, if you want to plant wildflowers, I would suggest going to native nurseries and native seed companies. There's lots of them in the upper Midwest, and buy plugs, buy seeds, gather seeds, find some community folks who've got some, you know, native prairie plants and collect local seeds. That would be my recommendation.
Yeah, and we're going to be talking.
Seeds are plentiful, right? Like, and you are going to talk about this later. Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to talk about this coming up around a little after 12:30 today. We'll be talking about planting a prairie garden in a small space.
And awesome.
So I want to go back to carrots, though, because you plant a variety of carrots or a number of species, types of carrots.
Yeah.
And they're really cool. Like, we got a great picture of carrots in your book that, and I like carrots a lot. And, you know, who doesn't like fresh carrots out of the garden? I mean, it's so different than what you might buy in the store.
Yeah, I had to buy carrots a couple of weeks ago at the store, and I was very sad about it because we ran out. Yeah, I like to grow some colorful carrots. I tend to grow, you know, purple haze or purple elite that are purple on the outside and orange on the inside. The rounded ones I grow often as an educational reason to show people that carrots can be round. Those are the best carrots for anyone who's got rocky soil, dense soil, heavy soil. They're called Parisian or Atlas carrots. And then I like to grow a lot of storage carrots. So, and again, these tend to be, carrots is another crop, Larry, where I do tend to buy the hybrids. Danvers 126 is a nice open pollinated variety. It's an improved Danvers, which is, I think, a Sharon Tay type, which is kind of a more of a blockier, pointed carrot, but they don't store as well as these hybrids, so I'm sort of feel a little locked into this. You know, I'm balancing the want to have my homegrown food stored versus, you know, I don't save my own carrot seeds. I mean,
yeah,
I'm not a carrot farmer, so I don't need that to be an open pollinated variety, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Well, I'd love to come to dinner at your place sometime, or even lunch or breakfast, because you have so many vegetables throughout the year. It's so much fun to have a chance to talk with you, Meg, about your book and about how you do it. And I know you've sold a lot of books already with this, but I hope you sell a bunch more, because it's a great book and you're great to talk with. I hope we can do this again sometime.
Thank you so much. This was really fun. I'd come back anytime and chat gardening. So let's do it. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Meg. Meg McAndrews Cowden, and her book is titled Plant, Grow, Harvest, Repeat. It's a dandy book. I think you'll love taking a look at it. And I think you're going to love hearing about small space prairies as well. That's coming up next. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. And if you think you have to have a lot of space to plant maybe a prairie garden, our next guest may just change your mind. Graham Laird Gardner is with us today. He has over 25 years of experience in landscape design and project management in, public, private, nonprofit sectors. A leader in high-functioning, water-smart, and low-maintenance landscapes. He's also an author, and we're going to talk with him about his book. It's titled Tiny and Wild, Build a Small-Scale Meadow Anywhere. Have you had any luck with a mini meadow? How did you incorporate it into your landscape? What questions do you have about the plants? give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Graham Laird Gardner, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you for the invitation, Larry.
So let's describe a mini meadow for us.
Mini is relative, of course.
Yeah.
But we wanted to talk about scales that work for people with smaller spaces. So it could be a balcony with containers. It could be part of your vegetable patch. It could be the corner of your yard, somewhere next to your mailbox, or something that you plan to expand in time, and you want to start small to see how to layer and what works in your spaces and your microclimates. But we're talking small, 10 by 10. I didn't specify in the book, but what feels manageable for you to get started.
Yeah, that makes sense. A lot of benefits to something like that.
The benefits, reduced maintenance over time, and attracting wildlife, supporting pollinators, exploring the native local plants in your area, density and biodiversity of the planting, bloom time over the course of the year, incorporating more plants. And enjoyment.
I just think it looks great.
Yeah, exactly. Beauty.
And it doesn't require a lot of work either. Once you have it established, for sure. Dave in
Correct.
Appleton has a question for you, maybe about a little bigger space. Dave, what's on your mind?
Yes, thanks for taking my call. So I've got a smaller lawn. Thought about changing it to a prairie. Type plants. I thought about skimming the grass off. You can buy these skimmers that take 2 to 4 inches off and maybe tipping that sod upside down and then planting the wild seeds in there. And I wanted low to the ground seeds because it is a lawn. What do you think of that?
I think that's a splendid idea. I think that's definitely a good way to start and prepare the space. And you can determine what your height range is and then look for species that are appropriate in your area for what it is you want to incorporate there.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe even a soil test to look at what you've got there, or telling the soil test people what you are planning to do, and that can help as well. Yeah,
absolutely.
Why not? And why not, Dave? This, I think it's a good idea. It's not going to work for everybody. If you've got young kids that are all soccer players on a lawn, it's not going to work. But if somebody like Dave maybe doesn't have that issue and wants to have that beauty, why not do it?
Well, to pause there, I'm not anti-lawn. I think lawn has its purpose, right? So
sure.
Depending on if you have dogs, if you have kids that play soccer, or you host events, and think of it more as a carpet versus a wall-to-wall rug, think of it as like a rug as opposed to a wall-to-wall carpet, and so scale the space that you want to keep mowed and activated based on the way that you use the space. And then you will have the corners and the edges to explore that small meadow possibility versus converting everything and feeling like this overwhelming intent versus and not being able to enjoy the space as you use it. I think we have a tendency to default to lawn because it's understood, it's easy to maintain, we can hire people. But the meadow maybe seems overwhelming, which is why I tried to break it down into a smaller space and really take the pieces apart so that people could explore it in those spots that they don't utilize often.
Yeah. And maybe this would be a good point before we go back to the phones to talk about the book and how it is organized.
Yeah, I try to walk people through the way that I approach projects in an accessible way for beginners as well as maybe more traditional perennial gardening people that are curious and don't know much about matrix planting or interplanting, tight spacing. So it's organized from getting inspiration from the designed and natural world and the local spaces around you, the native plant societies, all the way through to plant lists at the back, maintenance, installation. We've got, I tried to hit upon all the topics that I could think of. I would say the one part that maybe didn't get enough attention was identifying and finding ways to manage invasive species if those happen to be a problem on your property.
Yeah.
And maybe in the next edition.
Okay. Kyle in Winneconne, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Kyle.
Hey, how's it going? I think I have one of these natural meadows. I'm not sure. It's like in the middle of my lawn. It was like a former garden area and had like peonies in the front and back, but I kind of didn't do anything for the rest of it. So now I got like the little flowers coming up. I got some like daylilies popping. Would that be classified as like a natural meadow, or what type of maintenance do I need to do for this area? I'm not sure. Thank you.
So popped up in the middle of his lawn, basically, from the sound of it, Graham.
Sure. Well, Kyle, I would say if it's visually appealing to you, then you're on the right track. If you'd like to augment it or provide a little maintenance to it, you could identify those species that maybe are more dominant and that you wouldn't want and start to cull them, and then also add in additional blooming species in the periods of time where you don't necessarily have something blooming. So I think it's always great to work with nature and with what is spontaneously occurs and volunteer plants. The one thing I would caution against is to think of a meadow as an abandoned area, because often we have a lot of weed species or undesirable species that occur, and that it might be a little chaotic, and especially if there's an HOA involved or, you know, neighbors who are looking in. We want to also keep design in mind when, especially in a small space, when we're creating these gardens.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, and Kyle, sounds like Kyle may be like a lot of us who don't know the weeds, sometimes being able to, what's the weed and what isn't a weed here, or what's something that's kind of invasive. I had some neighbors who had a patch like that, and I couldn't identify all the weeds. And they actually just had hired someone, a naturalist, to come in and take a look at that space. That person pulled out were the weeds and left the others, and gave suggestions on what to put in where the weeds went out, and got a pretty nice looking space now.
That's a great idea. If you know of someone locally that is an expert who can help you begin to ID. Obviously, the learning curve there is there's a bit of one. I try to tell clients and friends and family to identify those things that are undesirable, maybe 3 to 5 species. Begin to familiarize yourself with what those things are, what seems to be dominant, and concern yourself with those, and allow the spontaneity to occur with what maybe you don't understand yet. Don't be overzealous with weeding. That's part of the charm of these spaces, is to allow that diversity and whimsy to enter. But certainly learn 3 of them. And if you know of someone who can come in as a consultant, or you want to go on a walk with a native plant society and ask questions, highly encourage that local connectivity with novices and experts and people who are also engaged and excited about this.
Yeah, absolutely. Donna in Stevens Point, we'll go to you now. Hi, Donna.
Hi. My question and comment is, I wish somebody had informed me when I started about rhizomes, because I was looking for my area, which is very shady and sandy, and so I was looking for plants that would, you know, would do well in my area, and I didn't realize that plants with rhizomes have been very happy and have taken off in my area, especially ostrich ferns and some other plants. And I've accidentally somehow have gout weed now, and that has just, even though I tried to pull it every year, it has just taken over and in my woodland area. And it's just, you know, almost unmanageable. So I just thought people should kind of be aware what they're planting.
Yeah. Donna, thanks for calling. Comments there, Graham?
Yes, certainly. Well, I happen to be, I'm guilty of loving ferns. So if ferns are taking off, I hesitate to encourage you to pull them out. However, if you want more diversity, consider donating them to friends and family, especially, I'm not sure if ostrich fern is native there. It was in New England. I love that fern. I think it's pretty stunning. The gout weed is absolutely an issue, and the local extension office probably has a fact sheet or a resource that could guide you in how to potentially manage it. I agree with stoloniferous plants in a small space, especially. I don't encourage. I encourage clumping species and to really know the plants and create a well-researched plant list before going in. Vet it with a few people, even if they're just friends who also like to garden. And always be cautious of giveaway plants, even though I'm saying share things with your friends. Most of the time when people give you a plant, it's because there's too much of it, and it might be that it's too rambunctious in their garden, and it will most likely be perhaps not problematic, but more aggressive than you might like, depending on the matrix that you're trying to set up.
Donna, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Graham Laird Gardner, our guest today, landscape gardener and author of Tiny and Wild, Build a Small-Scale Meadow Anywhere. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Taking a look at the book Tiny and Wild, Build a Small-Scale Meadow Anywhere with our guest, the author, Graham Laird Gardner. It's great to have him with us. Join in with your own questions or comments. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Not all areas are great sites for a prairie, big or small. What do you need to grow a successful mini meadow?
Ideally, if you'd like a highly flowering plant, you want full sun, most sun. You can absolutely create a meadow style, prairie style, in a shady place. However, it may not be as floriferous. And you want to understand your microclimate. So you want to be planting accordingly, selecting species that are appropriate for those areas, depending on the soil type, the pH, the drainage, the rainfall, and the light. So I think you can do it anywhere. I do include a shade list in the back of the book. I did write the book zone agnostic so that it would be more about process than about specific plants. And then I point people toward possible local resources where they can find more information in their area that's specific to their spaces.
Yeah. Jamie in Algoma has something for us. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, I would like to recommend the Picture This app. I downloaded it on my phone, and a few years ago I planted we just dug up this garden in the back and planted a whole bunch of wildflower seeds, and there had been a gardener previously. And when stuff started coming up, I thought, oh no, I don't know what's weeds and what's flowers. And this app, it's not foolproof, but it does a darn good job of helping you to, you take a picture and it identifies friend or foe, so you know what to pull and what to leave.
Jamie, thanks for calling. So picture this app.
Yes.
Great.
Fantastic recommendation, Jamie. I use a couple myself, and there are several out there that are free. Also some that have subscriptions. And depending on where you are and the content of the AI, it can be pretty accurate and give you at least the Latin name to then further research on your own and maybe cross-reference with the area that you're working in or that your landscape is in so that you can see how that particular plant behaves in that area, if it happens to be on the noxious weed list or if it's a native. To cross-reference the Latin name, as challenging as that might seem, it's the most accurate way to figure out what it is you're working with. Common names can be a little ambiguous, and oftentimes there are multiple species that use the same common name. So I always recommend copy-paste that Latin in and then your area so that you can see what the recommendations are, if there's any hits for how that plant behaves in your area.
I don't have that app. I'm going to have to put that app on. Thanks, Jamie. And you have another one that you use as well, Graham?
I use LeafSnap. It tends to be great for woody species, sometimes herbaceous species. And currently I'm in Puerto Rico, and it hasn't been as developed here in the tropical climate. But back in the States, from Rhode Island to Colorado to California, it was significantly accurate and at least pointing to the top three possibilities of what I might be looking at.
Mm-hmm. Jolene in Chippewa Falls, we'll go to you. Hi, Jolene.
Hello. We live in a rural subdivision, I'll call it. The lot sizes are about an acre. And we don't mow the ditch in front of our house. You know, it's a ditch, so it's probably 10, 12 feet wide. We haven't mowed it. We now have little blue stem, big blue stem, porcupine grass, about three different species of milkweeds, and a variety of things. Well, I know prairie, you know, they burn them. You know, used to have buffalo grazing on them. What's a good way to help maintain it, so to speak? Do we mow it on a basis? What would you recommend?
Great question. I think given that it's a ditch and potentially, dealing with inundation and a bioswale of sorts, then I would say, I forget if you said it was the front of your house, and that, of course, matters. A late winter cutback to 4 to 6 inches will clean up the messiness of it, perhaps, and remove that, put it in your compost pile, and then also monitor for the balance of diversity. If you want it to be more showcased, then perhaps if there's one dominant species, you might begin to remove that species and insert other things to create more diversity. I would look for rain garden plant lists in the area, and they often show species based on what location they are within the swale, and so you can understand where what would be appropriate depending on if it's at the bottom of the swale that's sitting in water or at the top of the swale. Very adaptable wetland species. Interestingly enough, they have to be able to tolerate inundation, flooding, as well as periods of drought. So aesthetic, you can evaluate it aesthetically if you wish to. However, it sounds like you have a great deal of diversity that's already happening, and you may wish to just do that one seasonal cut for tidiness, which I recommend as late as possible in the winter, especially if there are no spring bulbs that you're waiting for. There's a lot of overwintering insects and larvae and other things that benefit from that wild space that you've allowed to have occur in your front yard. And hopefully that's inspiring to your neighbors.
Yeah. And just cut it and leave it lay as well. Just kind of protect those insects that are maybe overwintering in the materials because a lot. No, go ahead.
The only reason that I recommend removing is because of building up too much organic matter. However, obviously in a native prairie, the everything's dying back and building that topsoil. So I guess that's part of the natural process. I've just found that in built gardens, in built landscapes, that we tend to want to over amend, and that organic matter over time breaking down can encourage more weed species and maybe more gangly, like tall flopping occurrences. And so the more you keep the soil, the less amended the soil, the better.
Yeah.
At least I found.
Yeah.
However, if you want to chip and shred it in place, it sounds like what would be happening anyway. And
yeah.
Also keeping that wildlife and those insects on property.
Jolene, thanks a lot. Kevin in Monona, your turn. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
So I'm staying with some friends at a historical property in Monona, 1887, and it has an Indian mound on it, so I can't excavate anything. And we have polkweed, and it's spreading all over the place. And I've literally dug down to the roots in one corner by a telephone pole and poured Roundup on that roots, and it still won't die. I don't know how to kill this stuff.
Polkweed?
Yeah, polkweed, it's like a bamboo kind of thing.
That is the worst.
Purple berries? Or is it the vine?
Spread underground.
Polkweed it is.
Yeah, that's where the common name can be confusing, because there's a polkweed that, at least in the Northeast, was native and misunderstood. And then there's I'm thinking of porcelain berry. So I'm not sure how it behaves out there. I would defer, because I don't like to make recommendations at all for chemical maintenance. I would defer to any fact sheets from the university, from the extension offices. Find out that Latin name, cross-check it with local resources for management as to best practices, and go from there.
Yeah, it is very, if it's what I'm thinking it is, it's very, very hard to get rid of. And you may want to get a hold of Lisa Johnson, the horticulture agent for Dane County. Easy to get a hold of her, Dane County UW Extension. And send her even a picture of it and ask for her advice, because if it's what I think it is, it's all very, very difficult, unfortunately, to get rid of. Kevin, give that a try. Thank you very much for calling. And Dave called to say that Seek is another app that he thinks is better than the other two that we mentioned. So the app Seek for weed identification, and Jill Nadeau likes it as well. And boy, the time's flown. Graham, thanks a lot for being with us. Hopefully we can get you back and talk again. His book is Tiny and Wild, Build a Small-Scale Meadow Anywhere. And nice to have him with us today. And nice to have you listening in for Garden Talk today. This and all our shows are kind of a team effort. Our producers are Clara Neipert, Joel Patnaud, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive director is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio News. Thank you for listening.